For most of us, it's quite likely that the use of the term rainforest conjures up images of a tropical or subtropical forest teeming with life, full of warmth and humidity. But rainforests are not restricted to the warmer parts of the planet. Temperate rainforests exist, too, and exist right here in the region we call home in California and Oregon. Those rainforests are the focus of a recent study to assess the value of them. The study comes with a long title and a lot of detail. The title is Multifunctionality and Biodiversity, Ecosystem Services in Temperate Rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, USA. There are a handful of authors, of which we have two with us today. Dominic Della Sala is the president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute based in Ashland. He studied rainforests for a long time, and he is president at the moment of the Society for Conservation Biology North America section. Dominic, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. Good to be here on this rainy day.
And by phone all the way from Argentina, one of the other authors of the study, Henrik von Verden, is from Lufana University in Lüneburg, Germany. His work focuses on the statistical analysis data as well as the ecological aspects of dry lands. Henrik, thank you for joining us.
Welcome. It's really great to be on board.
So let's get a little bit more background on each of you in turn. And we'll, Henrik, let's start with you. Tell us a bit more about yourself and some of the research you've been doing up until this study.
Yeah, for me, this all started during my PhD. So I was actually doing my PhD in Mongolia, which is kind of the opposite ecosystem. But then a common friend of ours got me involved into the book that Dominic was writing, the mandatory textbook. And this friend mentioned maybe it would be nice if some statistical model would be done there. And I sliced some time away from my PhD, and I remembered that I stood in this very ecosystem when I was a child. So we were traveling the western coast of the U.S., and I remembered that it was pretty nice. So I thought about this ecosystem, and I crunched some numbers, and then we came up with some results, actually, and they changed the book a little bit.
The book is Dominic's book, Temperate and Boreal Rainforests of the World, and you said it changed the book a bit?
Yeah, it kind of led, I would say, Dominic can correct me there, it led to a slightly altered chapter structure. So we encountered some regions where we thought that temperate rainforests are maybe not so prevalent. And some areas where people suggested that we have temperate rainforests, we had to say, okay, from a climatic perspective, from a modeling perspective, we might be wrong, but this is probably something a little bit different. So it altered slightly the structure of the book, and for me this was really the interesting starting point, because then, as Dominic already is, I became a little bit obsessed with these forests. And I visited them when I was in Argentina and Chile and looked a little bit around, and I remembered some other places where I went during my studies. And so I read a little bit more about it, and at some point I thought, okay, we have to really get to the beef. We really have to get some high-quality data there. And there the United States actually were a reasonable starting point, because Dominic is located there and because you actually have the best data structure, I would say, on the planet.
So, Dominic, was this really about sharpening up the definition of what constitutes a temperate rainforest?
I think so. I think that's why we took the project on back in 2010. There wasn't an up-to-date global map of the world's temperate rainforest, and surprisingly, we talked about this when we released the book, that these are the forgotten rainforests, because as you mentioned in your intro, when people think about rainforests, they think tropical rainforests.
And parrots and monkeys and all sorts of
things. Right, and those are really neat places. And we've got some really cool places, too. And, right here along the coast of Oregon and California, stretching up to Alaska, some of the world's most important rainforests that aren't getting the global attention that tropical rainforests are getting.
So what is the range of the temperate rainforests north to south, and are they generally west of the coast mountains or in the coast mountains anyway?
By and large, that's the case. There's only 10 regions of the world that constitute temperate or boreal rainforest. So they're quite rare compared to the tropical rainforests, which are distributed along the equatorial belt. And so the 10 regions of the world, we have 35% of the world's temperate rainforest. That's a big chunk of rainforest, and they're primarily coastal in their distribution, but not exclusively. One example of an inland rainforest is if you drive over to the interior of British Columbia and northwest Montana. It's wet enough there, and the forests are very similar to the Pacific coastal rainforest in terms of the species that we find. And so that was one of the surprise additions, that we actually do have some examples of inland rainforest. They're not just coastal.
So is it a certain level of precipitation that helps dictate it? Also certain species that exist in those forests that, that make them temperate rainforests?
Yeah, and this is where the partnership with Henrik's group came in. So what we knew at the time was there were specific localities that were indisputably temperate rainforest, and we had a climate data set. And we used that climate data set to structure the model, and then we asked the model to predict the remaining coastal and inland rainforest in the world, and that's what Henrik did.
Much more to talk about with our guests. They are among the authors of a study on temperate rainforests and the ecosystem services they provide. We'll start breaking things down and talk about what it means by multifunctionality and ecosystem services. Lots of terms to get through. Dominic Della Sala and Henrik von Verden, our guests on The Exchange. You can join us when we come back from the break, back here with them and with you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about the temperate rainforests of Western North America. Many of us actually live in or near them. And about the sorts of things that they provide to the people and the other critters who live around them. We're talking about ecosystem services. We'll explain that term as we go along. There's a recent paper on that, a study provided by two of today's guests. Well, our guests are among the authors of the study. Dominic Della Sala from the Geos Institute. He's the president and chief scientist there. Joining us by phone from Argentina is Henrik von Verden from Lufana University in Lüneburg, Germany. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the value of forests. Are they more valuable to us standing up? Are they more valuable to us leaving on trucks, or probably somewhere right there in the middle? We'll talk about that as we go through. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Do we feel like we defined temperate rainforests well enough, Dominic?
You know, I think it's worth repeating. And when we looked at it, we came up with a definition that was based on a global climate data set. And what we see in the world's temperate rainforests, and this is pretty obvious that when you're in these forests, you're in a wet place. And not only are you in a wet place during the rainy season, but in the summertime. And you can have up to 25% of the annual precipitation occurring in the summer. Think about the coast redwoods. You go into those forests, they are typically in a fog belt, or they're in the rain. Even in the summertime, it could be pretty cool in a rainy or foggy place. This is what we see around the globe. By and large, they're very moist places. And they also have or share very similarities in terms of the species that occur in those rainforests from the standpoint of lichens. And lichens are a relationship between algae and fungi that are living together in the same organism. And we see those in rainforests. If you go into the redwoods, for instance, you'll see lichens hanging from trees that also have moss in them, and there's a whole ecosystem in the canopy of these forests, and lichens are one of the definitive characteristics that we see in the world's rainforests.
So all kinds of things that make up a rainforest, and you have been, Henrik mentioned the word obsession, and is that the term you would apply to yourself and your feeling about rainforests?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it started for me in 1990 when I was on the Tongass rainforest as a young ecologists documenting the demise of these giant Sitka spruce trees that were being logged. And at the time, I wanted to do something about it. And years later, I had the chance to visit a lot of the world's rainforests and tell the same story. No matter where I was seeing the same thing, that they're going very fast, and I needed to get the message out.
Henrik, do I read from your credits that your work up to this point has generally involved drier landscapes?
Yeah, so I have a background in dryland ecology, so I'm coming from rangelands, but I would say what's the overall dominating thing is that I'm working in landscapes that are shaped by humans. So it's not so much that it's got to be dry or got to be forest. For me, it's pretty much what is the human factor in the landscape. So that's why, for instance, rangelands are for me as interesting as forests, where I'm also working in right now in Argentina.
You had mentioned earlier that your collaboration with Dominic did change the structure of his book about temperate rainforests of the world a couple of years ago. What was the starting point for this particular study, though, the one that was published recently?
I would say the started out because I got more and more engaged recently in this ecosystem service concept. So this concept came on the agenda some 20 years ago, or started to increase then. And it's basically about, you know, tree hugging is really nice, but with tree hugging you may not be able to save the trees. So what we need to calculate is, or need to understand, what are the values that people derive from ecosystems. So with this concept, this ecosystem service concept in mind, I, at this starting point, at just one evening, playing a little bit around. And what you have in the United States, which is really nice for me, is this Freedom of Information Act. So what we found out from a previous project, where we focused on climate change effects already, but what I saw then is you have a lot of data in the United States. And that's quite interesting. So there's a high data density in terms of what services people derive from ecosystems, from these ecosystems. But there's especially then also all this as spatial data. And this was for me the starting point where I thought, okay, wow, that's really a lot of information. And if we could synthesize this, we could test all these ecosystem services against actual biodiversity of the forests, which was Dominic referring to before.
So it wasn't a matter necessarily of collecting new data. It sounds like you had quite a bit of data available to you, but you simply pulled it all together in a new way?
Yeah, that's something that we have in an increasing rate in ecology right now. So there's a lot of information in the internet. You just need to properly assess it and analyze it. And I would say the United States are really a special case there, because they have information on deer hunting rates, on tourism, on how much salmon you get from the rivers. So really very specific information on the ecosystem. And for us, it was actually a dream. When we started it, we had much lower expectations, but we saw very fast that through all the data portals you have in the United States that we get a lot of information, and especially a lot of different information on these services that people derive from the forest.
Was it a lot easier to collect information in the United States than, say, in Germany or in Argentina?
Yeah, I think it's a different story. So I would say in Germany, it's pretty much having some regional variance, so it's not as stable as it is in the United States. And in Argentina, it's only starting. So for some information, you might have a high quality, but for other information, there might be nothing. So the United States, of course, has a long established track record of academic research, and there's also some pretty good management already going on. And all this, I would say, pools into this data that we then used from the internet.
So, Dominic Della Sala, when we use the term ecosystem services, what does that mean?
You know, it's what we get out of the forest. It could be provisioning services that we take from the forest without altering the way the forest is over time, such as these forests are giving us salmon, they're giving us clean air, clean water. So you can actually measure these and see how they relate to the biodiversity in that forest. But let me just give you a quick example of this. When you look at the world's temperate rainforest, some areas just come out as being globally significant. The Tongass rainforest, where I was last week up in Alaska, has the most abundant wild salmon fisheries in the world. And those fisheries are being sustained by that rainforest system. And so this is an example of a service, a benefit that we get from that ecosystem, the clean water that we get for our drinking water in a lot of communities that aren't on wells, for instance, is coming from intact rainforest or intact forests that haven't had logging roads or haven't had their soils damaged by logging equipment that causes sedimentation problems. So we're getting that clean water from those rainforests. And essentially what we tried to show in the study is that it's all together linked in these forests. So what we're getting out of the forest, nature is also providing to the wildlife that are also important to this region.
So there can be some consumption of products from the forest, because, I mean, people drink the water, catch and eat the fish. I'm thinking that maybe things like mushrooms and other things that they would cut and then would regrow. I mean, in other words, if it's consumptive and sustainable, is that an ecosystem service that doesn't change the ecosystem?
I think that's the key right there. I mean, we could take materials out of the forest, but we've got to do it within the capacity that the forest can sustain us. And so if we overemphasize any one of these ecosystem services, and timber is an ecosystem service, if we put too much emphasis on that, we compromise the other services that we depend on, such as clean water, salmon, wildlife.
So can some timber be taken out? Can you do some extractive work there on an industrial level and still maintain the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think so, but it depends. And it depends on what we've already taken and what we're leaving behind. And in the case of the temperate rainforest, when you look at, for instance, the Tongass, it's only one of five areas in the world that still have relatively intact rainforest, temperate rainforest. So we can only push these forests so much. And if we continue to log on the Tongass, we won't have that intact system sustaining all those benefits. The same thing in the Pacific Northwest. Again, I use the analogy, get up in an airplane, look out the window, look at all those clear cuts on that landscape. It's a shotgun blast. You can see it now with the snow out there, too. And so there, we could take products from these forests, and what we should be taking are from the already logged forests, the plantations. But going into old growth, for instance, we just can't take any more out of those forests without compromising the full range of ecosystem services that we get.
We are talking about ecosystem services derived from temperate rainforests, as in the kinds of rainforests that exist right in our backyards, with Dominic Della Sala, president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute, and his partner on the study, one of his partners, Henrik von Verden from Lufana University in Lüneburg, Germany, who joins us by phone from Argentina. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. We got a question from Jeannie in Medford who wants to know where specifically these are. Henrik, can you help us out with where rainforests exist in Southern Oregon and Northern California?
Yeah, I think definitely Dominic is the better person there, because I got to say the last time that I was there, I think it's now 28 years ago.
Oh, so a bit of a different situation. So Dominic, the question more specifically from Jeannie is the Siskiyous, are those rainforests or parts of the Siskiyous rainforests?
The Siskiyous are too far interior, so you got to get closer to the coast, west slopes of the Cascades as you head toward the coast. And the good way to do this is you're driving on Redwood Highway. And we all know where that tunnel is, right? You go through that tunnel, and it's really striking how the climate changes. I've been, you know, in that area many times, and I'll drive through that tunnel, and all of a sudden I'll hit the fog belt. That pretty much is a good distribution map for where at least our rainforests are. So if you go west of that tunnel, you're pretty close to being in the rainforest environment.
That's the Collier Tunnel, just a few miles south of the state line. I should also recommend for folks who have thought about doing this, get off the main 199 and go up the old road. It goes much longer and higher, and is a lot more windy and twisty, but you get a look at all the moss dripping off the trees up there and notice instantly that there is a bit of a difference. I'm sure people are going to think, based on what you just said about old growth timber, though, that you had an objective, a point you were trying to prove when you started the study, though.
You know, not really. We were just, you know, trying to see if there was a correlation between the diversity of ecosystem services in a specific area and the diversity of wildlife in that same area. And, you know, Henrik was really the lead on it, and I provided the connection to management. And the connection to management on this is that the Northwest Forest Plan, for instance, is based on a multiple-use perspective, so that if you're managing for multiple uses and you're not overemphasizing any particular extraction, then you're also managing for maximum ecosystem benefits and biodiversity.
So, Henrik, this brings up a great point. Do you have data that predate the Northwest Forest Plan and data collected since it went into effect, which is approximately 1994 or so, isn't it, Dominic?
Yeah, we'd really like to have a look back into the past. We did this on a preliminary basis already a little bit with satellite data, but the problem is the ecosystem services that we derived from that. We actually can't get any hold of that. So what we basically know is we know how forests were once distributed, and this is pretty alarming, because especially if you look at the southern patches of these forests, then this is really just some forest island here, some forest island there. And this is changing what we understood now, the resilience of these forests, especially towards climate change. So we think that in this region, climate change is going to hit hard, and it's going to hit the forests. So the reaction of these forests may be that they are shifting, but maybe this is happening all too fast, and maybe it's a too patchy distribution. and it won't happen at all. So we don't have that much a window into the past, but from a glimpse of what we can extrapolate into the future, we would say that much of the southern part of these forests is very much endangered.
Henrik von Verden and Dominic Della Sala are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about temperate rainforests, as in the kind that exist in our region. And so is there a minimum size then, Dominic? I mean, is there a size below which, if you make an island out of something, as Dominic, as Henrik was just talking about, it really doesn't function as a rainforest anymore? It doesn't hold weather to itself like big mountains do, for example?
Absolutely. We don't know exactly what that threshold is, but we've pretty much exceeded it, as Henrik pointed out, in the southern distribution of these rainforests down here in Oregon, California, highly fragmented system. So the islands of rainforest that remain have a very high penetrance of edge effects. So the climate changes because you get wind that goes further into the interior. You get a drying out of those forests. And the thing about these rainforests is that they are joined at the hip with moisture. And if you change that internal environment, it begins to alter the kinds of species that you get in there and therefore the services that we're getting from these forests as well.
And there have been some references already from both of you about climate change. Does that change the formula significantly in the sense that what would have been able to exist at a certain size or age of species of tree, for example, as a temperate rainforest 10, 20, 30 years ago, can't anymore?
That's very much a possibility. It's something that we make reference to in the book, that all these rainforests are experiencing climate change, like all the rainforests of the world are. And as we tinker with nature's climate, that's going to have potentially detrimental effects to what makes these rainforests so unique. It's that association with precipitation and cooler climates. And as we're heating up the planet and changing the precipitation patterns, just about everywhere in the U.S. this year had weird weather. And we certainly had our share here. It was dry for many, many months until we got hit with this blast of rain and we got very little snow. This is happening all over the world right now, and it's going to have consequences unless we get our act together in terms of our fossil fuel emissions.
Henrik, what have you noticed in your studies in Argentina and Germany with temperate rainforests and in other parts of the world that you've studied? I mean, how drastic a change are you seeing within those rainforests from climate change?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty severe. So I could just join in with saying that we have right now three times as much precipitation than we would usually have in this month. So it's pretty rainy right now, and this is a problem because what you can have then is you have this feedback loop that more rain leads to more plant growth. And if you then hit a dry spot and a fire comes, then you can have like really large fires. And in the forests here, we only recently witnessed that, where we had about thousands of hectares of forest burned. And in Germany, you know, this is a very different perspective because this is all gone for good. So all our forests are secondary. And from the climate models we did, I would suggest that in the Alps mountains, we would have some small pockets of temperate rainforests. And they are pretty close to relatives of mine living in Switzerland and Austria. But these are gone for good, you know. They are completely overformed. There's chainsaws and axes in these forests for centuries to an end. So you won't find the structure that you have, for instance, in the United States or in other areas where these rainforests still persist, such as New Zealand.
So you're saying no old growth whatsoever left anywhere in Germany?
I wouldn't say so. Yeah, it's pretty much all gone, I would say. We are living in what I would call a secondary steppe. So we have lots of changes that it's all moving towards agriculture since 50 years to an end. And all forests that we have are non-native species, or species that would not occur in that area. And that backfires severely. So we had, for instance, last year at all our larger rivers, a lot of floodings, and people got killed and villages were drowned. And it's like really a problem, you know. And we have this all over the world, as Dominic already stated. So if you look at the UK, you have the very same thing. It seems that we reached a tipping point and that the climate is really changing and altering the fate of the planet.
We have a whole lot more to talk about forests and ecosystem services, specifically the temperate rainforests of our part of the world. You can join us with Dominic Della Sala and Henrik von Verden when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about temperate rainforests, not the tropical kind, but the kind that actually grow right here near us in the state of Jefferson. We have them both in California and in Oregon, closer to the coast. Dominic Della Sala has been studying those for most of his adult life, and Henrik von Verden has gotten turned onto those as well. They were among the authors of a study with not that many pages of material, actually, but a long title. It's called Multifunctionality and Biodiversity, Ecosystem Services in Temperate Rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, USA. You can join Dominic and Henrik as we discuss this on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dominic, do temperate rainforests function something like a stabilizer on climate? In the sense that if they're big enough, they do act like mountains. They hold weather to them. They stabilize the weather around them. Drastic changes don't happen as fast in humidity and temperature, so forth.
Yeah, in fact, you can look at them as a green utility if you want. And, you know, one of the things that we looked at in the study was carbon and as an ecosystem service. And when you look at the world's rainforest, the coastal rainforest that we have in our region, in Oregon and California up to Alaska, are some of the most carbon-dense forests in the world. And basically, those giant redwoods are a big stick of carbon. So I have to take you back to your high school biology class. So you're sitting in high school biology, and your teacher's talking about photosynthesis. So the plants are taking carbon dioxide during the day out of the atmosphere. They're making their food by combining it with water and sunlight, and that's photosynthesis, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're sequestering carbon during the day, and then they're storing it over long periods, and that's what you see in those forests, a big stick of carbon sitting out there. So they can play a very central role in stabilizing our climate. Unfortunately, when we cut them down, most of that carbon goes back up into the atmosphere as a global warming pollutant. And it's very significant on a global scale. It is as significant, well, it's second only to industrial pollutants in terms of heating up the planet, deforestation and forest degradation. So a solution, a potential solution out here that needs to be tried on a bigger scale is saving those rainforests globally as a sponge for soaking up carbon dioxide.
But then you really have to apply an economic value to them, and it's a market that really doesn't exist yet, does it?
It actually does. The state of California is doing it. And there are a number of transactions that are happening right now where landowners are selling their carbon as an offset for a corporation that's looking to lower its carbon dioxide pollution in the state of California. And we have interest from landowners in Alaska, from landowners in this region. And the way it works is that they either hold on to their forest as set-asides or they extend their logging rotations over a longer period of time to give the trees more time to soak up and store that carbon. And then they sell those carbon credits as an asset to a corporation that's looking in part to lower its footprint by these offsets.
Have there been any major transactions like that yet, though?
There have. Last year, I believe, there was $267 million that was exchanged on the carbon offset market where willing landowners were selling their carbon offsets to corporations. Now, this is not the only way because the corporations also have to lower their emissions, but it's a good way to level the economic playing field for a conservation that also will help the climate in the long run.
Is this the first time that anybody's able to really make a buck off leaving their trees standing up? Other than just having people come look at them and charging admission or something?
It is, and there are different ways. There are different models that are working around the world. In the global arena, there's a program that the UN has developed called RED, Reduce Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation, where the countries in the developed world are paying the developing world not to log their rainforest as a carbon sink.
Henrik von Verden, you're from Germany, and that in some ways seems to be a little further advanced on at least coming to grips with the idea of climate change, global warming. Are carbon markets developing there for forest use?
Yeah, definitely. So we also have the very same direction. I mean, we also try to shift our energy use right now, and there's, I think, a lot of potential how we can learn from each other on that. So, for instance, in terms of how you construct your houses, the whole transportation business and all that, this is widely shifting in Germany right now. And I'm also working a little bit on the negative impacts of nuclear energy use. So there's really a lot of discussions going on, and I would say we're moving into a common direction in Germany right now, and there's a lot of change going on. But the problem is still that these ecosystem services are not widely recognized. So there are some things, as Dominic outlined already, and there are other things that we recognize, like pollinators and other topics. But it's really the diversity of different ecosystem services that, for me, make the difference for the temperate rainforests. And that is something that we hardly have in Germany. We don't have these diverse semi-primary ecosystems anymore.
Are they mostly plantations at this point? You mentioned they're all second growth and probably even well beyond that.
Exactly. And this is really why these regions in the U.S. are making a huge difference for us, because there it's like if you have more tree species, you have more services. Now, people would argue, okay, that's logical if I have an apple tree, a peach tree, and so on, but it doesn't work that way, you know. It's all sorts of trees where you don't see a direct linkage. It's more like you have more tree species and you have a higher salmon abundance. And this is a bit tricky to get. This is the thing that was really puzzling us, that if we have more tree species, we also have a higher diversity in services that people, where people benefit from these forests.
So this is the biodiversity part of the whole thing, multifunctionality and biodiversity. With biodiversity, then you get a greater level of ecosystem services. Is it just more of everything if there's, well, basically there's more of everything if there's more of everything? Is this what we're saying, Dominic?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, it comes down to whether or not your forest is intact. If your forest is intact, then you've got all the services intact, and you've got biodiversity in those forests. When you fragment them and you bring them down to the point where in our region there's less than 20% of our old-growth forest, those forests no longer provide the services and the biodiversity that the intact rainforests do. So we're seeing some pretty significant trade-offs when we overemphasize one utilization over the others.
Let's take a call. We have John in Veneta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking temperate rainforests and ecosystem services with Dominic Della Sala and Henrik von Verden.
Good morning, guys. This is a very important topic to me. I always like to start out with telling folks that my family goes back to like 1870 logging in Oregon, and I've been in wood products all my life, wood products, you know, work, endeavors. So it's not like I have a bent that way necessarily. I absolutely cannot stand the idea of anybody cutting down any more of our virgin forest, and that's what I've called about. And Jeff's probably going, oh, here he comes again. Every time I get
fine.
A chance, I want to talk about terminology. If we could get people using the same language, and old growth don't get it. I've watched people talk right past each other for 30 years. Virgin says what it means. When you talk primeval forest and all that, and the chain of life that these gentlemen are talking about, and I'm so impressed, and I just love and hear it because people need to know it. We luckily got a place called Devil's Staircase saved here recently, because there's hardly anything left in the Coast Range in Oregon that hasn't been, you know, ripped down, third time even some of it, which is okay. Some of it, we need a timber base. But to leave none of it, to go to a place like that and see giant newts and the chain of life that you won't see in a mono forest. You won't see the chinkapins and the madrones and the kind of intermingle of life. And we're going to lose something big if we don't get smart.
All right, so the vote here is for virgin forest.
Yep, virgin forest.
All right, thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. How important is the terminology when you look at that? You've been in the middle of the debate for quite a long time now, Dominic.
You know, terminology is important, and the caller was absolutely right. And, you know, we are looking through the same lens, virgin forest, old growth forest. And we have reduced those to the last 20% or less than that in our region that used to be here when Native Americans were in the region, much more than they are today. And so I also think it's important to look at the mature forest, because that's where we have the opportunity to recruit old growth forests over time. So it's that next age class. They're not quite old growth or not quite virgin, but they're going to get there if we don't log them. And so if we're going to restore an ecosystem, that is the age class that's absolutely critical. And it's the one that's right now in the crosshairs, for instance, for, you know, Senator Wyden's bill.
Are these the matrix lands as opposed to the late successional reserves that are more or less set aside?
A lot of them are in the matrix, but in Wyden's bill, they would transfer out of the reserves and move into a forestry emphasis area, and we would see more of these clear cuts in the mature forest that give them a few more decades and they become old growth.
We have an email here from David in Ashland. He asks, how best can we manage the converted forest areas that are now even aged and prone to hot fires? Granted, the older forests were better, but now we have thousands of acres of plantations and they keep burning often and hot.
That is a great question. And it's another area I work on, both ends of the moisture continuum, the rainforest side where we really don't have a fire problem and the dry forest side where there's a fire problem, as the caller mentioned, particularly the dry forest plantations. And so plantations have really kind of set a firebomb across the landscape, and the roads are the fuse for that firebomb. The more roads we have in an area, the more access, the more accidental fires. These plantations are densely packed, small trees. When a fire comes through, it just blows up in them. So we have created these artificial conditions for fire to really blow up. So in order to change that dynamic, we could be doing restoration work, put people into the woods with ways to cut those trees, reduce their density, thin them out so that over time they look more like a forest and less like a plantation and are less susceptible to these blow-ups when we get a fire.
Let us take another call. Here's Kathy in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dominic and Henrik.
Yeah, hi. excuse me. I wanted to talk about the ONC lands and the Senator Wyden's bill that Dominic just mentioned.
Right.
That, that is our current battle to save some forests that are under attack and encourage people to pay attention to that, because it's being marketed as a thinning project when, in actuality, I understand a lot of the area that's going to be sold to loggers is going to be, in actuality, clear-cut. Although they may not be calling it clear cut, they may be calling it thinning. We saw this in the Biscuit Fire. They claimed that the logging afterwards was going to be thinning, when in actuality, they might have left a tree or two, over each acre, and that was what they called thinning.
Right. The terminology then is somewhat flexible. Let's get Dominic's take on that. So, is that the case, Dominic? Where people, you were just talking about these overstocked stands that are very densely packed, which is often the argument made by the timber industry. We have to go in there and get this stuff out, so it's not a big fire problem. Where do you differ then?
Well, where we differ is that the plantations are overstocked. They're single species monocultures, so the fire comes through, it hits a continuous fuel cell, and it blows up. We don't see that in a native forest. And we have done studies in the region that show this, that the plantations are much more susceptible to these kinds of crown fires that we see than native forests are. In native forests, there's just a lot of variability out there, so you get a very variable fire. You get some areas that burn in low intensity and other areas that burn in high intensity and some areas that don't burn. So that's the typical fire mosaic that we get in our region. When we move the landscape into a fire bomb where we've got so many plantations out there, then we've got a situation where the fires blow up in the plantations.
Henrik, when I look at the study, and granted it, again, is not that long, but it gets a little dense at times. There's pretty dense stuff in here, like Simpson diversity metrics. Who is this intended to be used by?
Yeah, we actually want to link. So, of course, this is a scientific study. This is pooling back into the scientific community. But exactly what we are doing right now, talking about it on the radio, I think is one of the prime issues that we need to do. And this is also why I'm so happy that we are working together with Dominic, because he's exactly the person doing that. So for me, it's like a perfect opportunity, because science cannot be in that ivory tower totally isolated from the people. We need to link back, we need to reconnect. And all these results may look complicated, but for me, there's a very easy threshold. If I can explain that to my mother without all this math and everything, then it's going to work. This is the test that I put all my work to, and this is how it should actually work, because we need to get this back to the people, and we also need to get this into management.
We have less than a minute left, but I want to get in this email from Tim in Eureka. He says, it seems that forests are a vital organ of this planet. How would reforestation affect climate change, and is there any current planning for global reforestation? Anything you're aware of, Dominic?
I think reforestation can play a role, provided that we're not causing continual deforestation, because when we chop those trees down, we lose a lot of that carbon. But in places that are agriculture or, you know, need to come back to forest, those places certainly can sequester more carbon by planting trees, particularly native species and native densities.
Dominic Della Sala is with the Geos Institute, the president and chief scientist. He is also the author of the book Temperate and Boreal Rainforests of the World. He is one of the authors of this study with Henrik von Verden, who is from Lufana University in Lüneburg, Germany, and yet joined us from Argentina today. The study is called, if you want to look it up, Multifunctionality and Biodiversity, Ecosystem Services in Temperate Rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, USA. Dominic and Henrik, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about colon cancer prevention efforts. We will talk at 8:30 about conversations about the end of life with a chaplain in hospice. And then we'll meet the author of the book, The Contest of the Century, about China and the world in the century ahead. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.